to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Got John Cozy back today. Regulars know John well. He's a retired philosophy professor. He writes on, well, he's writing now. He taught for many years. He's been writing for many more. He writes about social, political, and economic issues. We want to talk about a great article that John wrote, his newest article. He talks about the real New World Order. Well, I remember writing about the New World Order that Bush Sr. talked about in a... It was either a congressional address or a State of the Union address. It was 20-odd years ago, around 1990, 1991. He declared a new world order. He wasn't talking about the one that John talked about. John, give me just a moment. I'll make a couple of comments, and I'll let you jump in. Jack Rasmussen, in the previous hour, Jack comes on my program often. He tells it like it is. He's absolutely right. Tax cuts are a waste of time, except... I didn't hear the whole program, the Jack, all of his comments. What he was talking about was tax cuts to the rich. You know, they use it for whatever they use it for. Buy more stocks, more bonds, more whatever. They certainly don't stimulate the economy. Tax cuts for corporations, they either hoard the cash. According to Federal Reserve data, it's about $2 or $3 trillion. According to all, if you add in all the stuff that they hoard offshore, you know, secrete away in secret accounts, tax havens, whatever, it's more like $5 trillion. And I wrote about that in an article some days ago. It does absolutely no good. They use other money for stock buybacks, for big salaries and bonuses, for speculative buyouts. Nothing generates job creation. They're not creating jobs. They're destroying jobs. You read about layoffs all the time. I've got a new article I put out today. It's top featured on my blog, Steve Lindman blog. I call it Economic Straight Talk. You'll never get that from the Wall Street Journal or from Bloomberg or the Financial Times once in a while throws a few kernels of good stuff at readers. They're the best of a bad lot. But the rest of them, forget about them. They're not going to tell you what's going on. They tell you the economy is healing. The hell it's healing. We're going through a protracted depression. And I usually put a capital D on that when I write about it to distinguish it from the other kind of depression, emotional depression. But, you know, like ham and eggs, one goes with the other. Or at least when you have economic hard times, you often have emotional hard times as well. And millions of people are suffering horrendously in America, across Europe. Why? Doesn't have to be. It's not rocket science to run an economy responsibly. It takes a great effort to do it irresponsibly, and that's the way America is run in the European economies. Forced austerity, force-fed austerity, when real help is needed, stimulus, it can easily be generated. Again, it's not rocket science. Governments should control their own money. They don't. They let central bankers control their money. They print an awful lot of it. They hand it to corporations, to bankers. They buy out sovereign debt. They do nothing for ordinary people. John, I could keep this up for the rest of the hour, but let me let you jump in on the New World Order. I think you nailed it. It's going to take time, but I think that New World Order at some point is going to emerge triumphant.
Well, I don't know about triumphant, but it'll emerge. One of the things I noticed a long time ago, and I have been pushing this in various papers about on various topics for a long time, and that is that the United States of America and European civilization in general haven't really progressed at all since the 17th or 18th century.
John, let me interrupt one second. My studio is having a little bit of trouble hearing you, so maybe you can raise the audio level just a smidgen.
I'll try.
Okay, thanks. I think that's better.
What I was saying is that a long time ago, I noticed that Western civilization, and the United States in particular, hasn't really progressed any since the 16th or 17th century, and maybe longer than that. It appears as though we have progressed in that various technological advances have made certain things in life more tolerable and easier to bear, like our houses are better and that sort of stuff. But when it comes to dealing with human beings, we're just as brutal today as people were in the 16th century. And one of the things about the 16th century that no one seems to recognize is that in the 16th century, conflict between people was really restricted to conflicts between nation states. But since the end of the Second World War, conflict does no longer exists between nation states. It exists between certain nation states and people in general. And it goes on interminably. I pointed out that, take the Korean War, for instance, which was the first war after the Second World War. It is, theoretically at least, still in progress. When one talks about the North Koreans not paying any attention to international consensus and that sort of thing, nobody points out that the international community is still at war, technically, with North Korea. I mean, it was an international force that, you know, went and defended South Korea when North Korea went into South Korea, and that war has never ended. It's North Korea against an international group of states. So when people talk about, you know, North Korea being outside of the international community, yeah, it is. It's at war with the international community that we want to define as an international community. And, you know, that kind of thing, this long-standing, unending wars, is a new feature of the world that wasn't present in the 17th century. I mean, in the 17th century, you may not have known exactly when the war was going to end, but you knew how it was going to end. One army would surrender, and that would be the end of it. Sooner or later, that of course would happen. But that's no longer the case anymore, because we're not fighting armies anymore. And I thought that was interesting in the hearings for the new head of the CIA. When he was asked about whether or not, you know, if an American was on the kill list, he could surrender, and he said something, well, any American who joins an organization like Al-Qaeda, and he used that phrase, organization, and here we are, you know, we're no longer fighting a country, we're fighting an organization. And that's an enormous change from what was going on in the 16th century, or 17th century, or 18th, or even in the 20th century. And I thought to myself, you know, why doesn't somebody ask him what would happen, you know, if we went to war with, say, the Bilderbergers? That's an organization.
You know, I'm all for that, John.
Yeah, why not go to war against the Bilderbergers? But of course, nobody in Congress is smart enough to ask a question like that. Nobody in the press is either. So anyhow, I would to go on with this. And we didn't learn anything. When the Korean War, when the hot fighting stopped in the Korean War, we didn't learn anything from that. I mean, here we have an international community fighting a puny little country. Of course, it was helped by China, which is not a puny little country, but we couldn't win. We have not been able to win to this day. So would we learn anything from it? No. The French got wise in Vietnam and realized they were never going to win that war. So, you know, they're going to pull out, but American hubris, you know, we can do what the French can't do. We can go in there and beat that North Korean army. They were viewing it as an army-army war. But it was never an army-army war. It was an American war or a French war against an indigenous people. There was no army that was ever going to surrender. Even if the North Koreans had pulled back their military force, the people in the South weren't going to surrender to the Americans. I mean, you know, well, sure, you know, the American may have been able to force another government on them, whatever, but the war would have gone on in one way or another. And you know, eventually, what do? We just put our tails between our legs and left. And that's exactly what we did when we got to Iraq. You know, that was, again, not a war against army. It was a war against the people. And the people, you know, the people don't surrender. I mean, to get a war like that to end, you have to kill all the people. You know, and that's what we're trying to do with things like drones and other kinds of weapons. We somehow or other we have this notion that we can kill all the combatants. Well, we can't. And you know, so the result is that, you know, now throughout all of the Arab world and maybe other places too, we have Americans trying to go to war against organizations, and we pretend that these organizations are all one, that they're all related to one another. But of course they're not. I mean, they're just people who have the same, they think alike perhaps, but there's no general in charge who's telling them what battles to fight or how to fight them or anything like that. And we're engaged in a worldwide war against people, period. Okay? And you can't win any such war, and that is the New World Order, basically.
John, I think that's so important. I think that's such an important point. I would just add a couple of things. Since World War II, America has not fought a legal war, and America has not won a war. All the wars going on now, America has not won them. The Korean War, an armistice ended the hostilities, but a state of war still exists. That's different. No state of war exists in Southeast Asia that I'm aware of. But, you know, anything could start up again any time. When I said these forces, the indigenous people, will emerge triumphant, in the back of my mind, my thought was that every empire in human history eventually came a cropper. They wrote their own epitaph by their overreach, by their overspending, by all of their excesses, and America will be no different. America is spending more on militarism, including at home, than the rest of the world combined, and has a permanent war policy. You simply can't keep this up forever. It's been this way for decades and decades and decades, and sooner or later, this empire will fall just like all of the others. People a lot smarter than me have said that, John, and that's what I mean. I don't know who, and there'll be another empire, I guess, that'll rise up. So ordinary people will have to keep fighting for their independence. But that's what I meant by the New World Order that you speak about, that will emerge triumphant. At least it will, in the sense that it will still be around when America's empire no longer is around. That was my thought.
Well, yeah, and you would think that Americans would have learned a long time ago that empires come and go. You know, they don't last. They never have, and they're not about to now. But Americans are, you know, they're stupid, especially people in the governing elite are stupid. They think that they can force whatever they desire onto people, and of course that doesn't work. It never has worked, and it's not going to work now. So you know, I mean, that's anyhow. You know, the point of my paper was pretty simple. I mean, if you continue to view the world as army against army, country against country, et cetera, you're going to get involved in wars that have no termination point, and to which no one can possibly win, and that's exactly what we're doing. And the New World Order is a recognition that that's no longer the case. That an organization like the Pentagon, which builds armies, is an outdated organization.
Again, I think that's so true, John. I wrote after North Korea conducted its nuclear test. I wrote an article I called Beating Up on North Korea. I don't write on North Korea very often. Last time was a good many months ago. There was a confrontation at sea. I mean, North Korea is used as a punching bag all the time, and the real target is China, not North Korea. And the real problem with North Korea is the country was divided after World War II. You know, the imperial power is, Russia had something to say about that. They certainly were very much involved in the war. But to take an independent country and carve them up like a piece of salami in two pieces, well, Germany was several pieces of salami, but basically you had the East and the West sectors, and to do this. But in my article that I wrote about Korea, I revisited the Korean War, and I think it punctuates what the comments that you made, that the Koreans weren't going to give up. I mean, they valued their sovereignty, and in one way or another, they were going to keep fighting for it. But America literally turned North Korea into rubble. The U.S. forces ran out of targets. And I use material that Bruce Cummings, who's a historian at the University of Chicago, he's written a number of books on the Koreas, and he wrote about this. Literally, I quoted him verbatim. I mean, literally, you take a country and you turn it into rubble. I also mentioned how MacArthur wanted to use nuclear weapons. He wanted to create a nuclear belt across the border, I think, with China. And Truman vetoed that, and I remember well when he recalled MacArthur. It was just about the time, I think, that we got a television set in our household, John, and I remember watching MacArthur's, was it his farewell address? What did he call it? Did he call it his farewell address to Congress?
Well, something like that.
Soldiers never die.
Old soldiers never die. They just fade away, and then he died.
We all die at some point, but I saw that address live on TV, and I could probably look it up and check verbatim exactly what he said. And one more thought, then I'll let you get back in. I have a treasure trove of a library that I've collected over time, and most of the books are used books because they're so much cheaper to buy that way. I'm a great fan of I.F. Stone. I read virtually all of his books, and one of the books I read was one he called The Hidden History of the Korean War. Even while the war was ongoing and we didn't know a lot of stuff that we learned later, he was writing about stuff that nobody else talked about. And I was lucky enough to get a book. I didn't really check it carefully when I got a used copy. And some months after I got it, I just, in opening the book, opened to the spot where you usually don't open, the cover before you turn the first page. And I'll be damned if I.F. Stone didn't sign that book for somebody. And that damn fool turned it in as a used book. I don't know what he got for it. I mean, a damn fool. I mean, it's a collector's item. I paid $10. I'll bet you couldn't buy that book for $100 now. Anyway, John, a little sidebar. I'll let you get back to the article that you wrote.
Well, yeah, you know, I've summarized that the rest of the article is basically argument, and which is, you know, one of the characteristics of my argument, my pieces. I mean, I don't like pieces that consist merely of claims. I want evidence, and the rest of, you know, the article that I've just summarized is argument, and it, you know, I think it's convincing. I don't know whether it is or not to everybody, but it is to me. Appears convincing, and so much for that. The Western world, I'm absolutely convinced this is true. The Western world wants to perpetuate the 16th century. That's what it's trying to do. And in the 16th century, it was a very simple place. You know, aristocracy had all the wealth. Everybody else was a debt slave. A lot of them lived in debtors' prisons. Adam Smith thought that a fair wage for people working and, you know, for others was a subsistence wage, nobody had a right to anything but the aristocracy, which already owned everything, and and our economists and our lawyers have perpetuated that system, continue to perpetuate it, as though somehow or other that is a just way to run a culture. And of course it's not. It's an atrocious way to run a culture. And but that's what we're doing.
We sure are doing it, John. We're doing it and so much more. I mean, literally waging war on humanity. America has a permanent war policy. I wrote a couple of major articles about it. And you look back at U.S. history, you go back as far as you want to go. America has always been at war, either abroad or at home or both. It's now waging multiple wars, direct wars, proxy wars. The countless millions of people that have been killed by America's wars, the countless harm that's been done at home, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about George Bush or Obama, or go back as far as you want to go. There was always something nefarious going on, and the human misery.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's obvious. I mean, it's in that paper somewhere, I think. I don't remember. You know, I forget what I write pretty quickly after I find it. Because I start writing something else. Huh? But I pointed out, I think, that the people who landed on Plymouth Rock were not peace loving, sympathetic humanitarians. I mean, they were vicious people.
They sure as hell were.
I mean, you know, they wouldn't. They're the people who didn't think anything of burning their own women at the stake. that was true in the 1600s in America, and it was always true. You know, Abraham Lincoln. Now that there's this movie out about him, he's always thought it was this great humanitarian president. I pointed out in the article, I think, that he fought a war to hold the Union together which never came back together anyhow, as we could tell from what goes on today, which ultimately freed the slaves in America and then left them to fend for themselves, but in the process killed something like 750,000 Americans. This can be great humanitarian. I mean, if you want a war, kill 750,000 Americans. Okay, yeah, okay. I pointed out that the Tsar of Russia freed millions of serfs by signing a piece of paper. Didn't kill a single soul, but those wicked Russian czars. You know, I mean, that's kind of stupidity that Americans never pay any attention to. He didn't have to. He didn't have to kill 750,000 Americans to free the serfs, free the slaves. It was a warlike nation. It's a warlike nation then. It's a warlike nation now, and it hasn't changed. The gun culture in America is a direct descendant of that war. Attitude that Americans have always possessed. I mean, I put in there, I don't know if it was this paper or the previous one, but I put in there, we didn't settle the West. We shot our way from the Mississippi to the Pacific. I mean, and there's a big difference between shooting your way and settling the territory. We even have a phrase that the Remington rifle, 1871 or 18 something or other, is the gun that won the West. I mean that's the way we brag. America. Think of the national anthem, bombs bursting in air.
The American credo, bombs bursting, whether they're in air or any other place, bombs bursting.
Yeah, anybody who talks about America as a peace-loving nation just doesn't know American history. I mean, that's all there is to it. Of course, nobody does know American history because we don't teach it in our schools.
That's for sure. That's for sure. By the way, on the Civil War, it's been so long, but I extrapolated the death toll from the Civil War based on the population of America as of maybe 5 years ago. And math was never my long suit, but I'm sure I was pretty close to being right. If the population then was what it was about 5 years ago, instead of the number you mentioned, John, there would have been something like 12 million American lives lost.
Yeah.
In World War II, it was about 365,000.
Yeah, you know, the current debate about, you know, gun control is a debate about what we value most. And there are a good number of Americans who believe that they value the ability to own a gun more than the ability to save a life. I mean that's what America is like, people. I thought when I was listening to the State of the Union address, I said that's not a State of the Union address. I mean it's just political posturing. You want to give a State of the Union address? You know, compare America to other countries. I mean, you know, our social safety net is one of probably the worst of any industrial nation. Our schools are failing. We can't provide medical care. Homelessness and poverty. I mean, you know, give a list of really a comparison of America to the rest of the world, and that's the state of your nation. And I would have asked, if I had been president, I would have done that, and I would have asked every congressman to stand up, take a deep breath, and puff out his chest and yell, "How proud I am that this is my country!" You know, but Americans don't have any damned imaginations.
That is so true too, John. They are too focused on things that don't matter, and they spend precious little time, if any, worrying about the things that are most important that affect them directly. I say it over and over again on this program. I know I'm preaching to the choir, I know, and the only thing I ask the choir to do is preach it to people who don't understand or don't take the trouble to understand or don't understand enough or understand but don't do anything about it or don't do enough. Well, you get the point. And we're in trouble because of that. Let the people who run their governments literally get away with murder, then what the hell do you expect from the kind of government that you have? And it keeps getting worse and worse.
I'm thinking about writing a paper and showing that, look, you know, you can't, the President of the United States can't have a kill list and brag about killing someone in another country. The Pentagon can't, you know, have body counts and then pretend that you care about the people being killed in America. You just can't do it.
You sure can't do it, John. We're going to take a short break.
I hear the fat lady.
Oh, indeed, the fat lady's the boss. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come right back. Welcome back. On with John Cozy, talking about the New World Order. John, about a half hour after this program ends, I'll have an interview from a Jamaica radio station, and they asked me to come on to talk about Obama's State of the Union address. Well, I wrote an article before he made it, and I wrote an article after he made it. The one after it I called Obama's Failed State. Let me just quickly mention a couple of things I said in it. I talked about his plan to push very, very, very destructive trade plans, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There's another one He wants to have a, this was just announced in the major media, and I wrote briefly about it. The details will come out later. A transatlantic partnership. I mean, these are one-way deals where ordinary people get terribly, terribly harmed, where legislatures and countries have no power to override the rules that these trade agreements put into force. I wrote about his notion of literally destroying Medicare and Social Security, eroding Medicaid, really taking it down to nothing. And I put in some lines to the effect that I talked about extrajudicial killing. We know about that. I wrote a couple of separate articles on that and his kill list and so on. And I wanted to find the spot that, oh yeah, here was the spot. He ticked off a number of things in his address, and I should have put in more. I stuck mostly to the things he talked about, but I couldn't double the list that I wrote. But I talked about he wants to modernize public schools by privatizing them. His immigration proposal mocks notions of welcoming tired, poor, wretched masses yearning to breathe free. His energy program prioritizes drill, drill, drill. His cybersecurity scheme involves no holds barred cyber war. His notion of economic prosperity is greater corporate empowerment and enriching America's privilege. His housing program lets bankers scam ordinary people. His minimum wage proposal falls way below the poverty line. His Afghanistan plan is permanent occupation. The one line I should have put in was his peace plan is permanent war, and that's exactly what it is. And there's so much more that I could have put in, but I covered a lot of ground, and I also called his State of the Union address demagogic boilerplate, wall to wall, from beginning to end. John, you listen.
I read
to
that
it.
Piece yesterday of yours, and it's the kind of thing that goes on in America. You know. I presume you're aware of the big crisis, controversy, whatever, over the doping controversy and the Tour de France thing and whatever his name is. Ben.
Oh yeah, Armstrong.
And we make a big deal of this, and I thought to myself, he cheated. No kidding. Who the hell in America doesn't? What about blank fines cheating? What about a congressman's lying? Not cheating? Cheating is an American virtue. When Obama talks about a trade agreement with the European Union, what does he want to do? He wants to make the European Union import foodstuffs that they think are dangerous. I mean, it's obvious. We're not gonna get anything from Europe in that trade agreement. That trade agreement's not going to work any better than the North American trade agreement has, but it'll make it possible for adulterated foods to get shipped to Europe. Who knows what else? I mean, that's what it's just American hegemony carried out in a different realm. That's all. We're going to force the Europeans to eat what we want them to eat. Okay, buy what we want them to buy. Breathe the air we want them to breathe. That's all it is. It just boggles my mind how Americans can hear all this stuff and not put two and two together. Talk about the sequester and all this crap about, gee whiz, if we take any money away from the Pentagon, we're going to put our national security at risk. Our troops won't be trained, and they won't have the equipment they need. And I scratched my head, and I said, we sent them to Iraq without the equipment they needed. Don't you remember people having to buy armored vests to send to their kids over there in Iraq. That was big news, you know, back then. And I said to him, what's he talking about? Our defense budget is larger than the defense budgets of the next 10 or 15 countries combined. But we can't cut any of our defense budget because it's going to endanger our national security.
It's going to endanger Lockheed Martin's bottom line.
Yeah, that's all it's going to endanger. You know, but nobody will say it. I heard all of these discussions about the sequester of the Pentagon funds, and no one in any of those discussions that I have heard has ever said, hey, wait a minute, compare that to the size of the Pentagon budget in comparison to the size of China's.
You know, China's is minuscule compared to ours.
Yeah, you know, but we don't get that stuff. We never hear that stuff, and it just boggles my mind. They're making all these protestations about North Korea's having a nuclear test. God, they got one missile that they can fire and two bombs or whatever, and they're going to be a catastrophic, danger to the United States of America. And I say, hey, wait a minute. Didn't President Reagan build a missile defense system? I haven't heard a word about that in relation to North Korea's ability to put a bomb on a missile and aim it at America. What happened to the missile defense system that everybody was talking about a few years ago? Yeah. Aren't we putting a missile defense system in Eastern Europe that's supposed to protect us against Iran? Aren't we?
Well, I call it what it is, John. It really is a first strike system, and it targets Russia China.
My point is that, you know, we claim that we're building these systems to protect us, and then when somebody else builds one bomb, we say, oh my God, they're going to kill us.
When it comes to a country like North Korea, or any country, I mean Russia, during the Cold War for so many years, we had mutual assured destruction (MAD), and neither country would ever dream of attacking the other one. Even though one time we came very very close by accident during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, and that was a put up American job too. I mean, we had ringed the Soviet Union with missiles.
Oh, for sure.
You know, but they're going to put a missile in Cuba. God Almighty, you're going to kill us.
And John, that was during the Kennedy years.
Yeah. Kennedy, but you know, the Kennedy years. He was a great president, I guess. I don't know. Whoever knows?
Dead. Compared to the ones that came after him, he was very very dovish. He wanted to get out of Southeast Asia. I'm certain that's the reason the CIA murdered him. He also wanted the Palestinians recognized. He had a lot of good ideas.
Well, but he was also the guy who said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And
well,
that's a good fascist rubbish, yeah. You know, I mean...
But we came within an eyelash of a nuclear war during the missile crisis.
I know.
October 1962.
I was teaching in the southern United States at the time, and everybody was running around with a shovel.
Oh, I don't remember that. I don't remember that. But I remember all the fuss and muss about it. But just imagine if we ever had Obama or George Bush in charge back then. I mean, we might have gone a nuclear war. You can't tell.
Sure.
I mean, Kennedy didn't want a war, and later on he said so. He didn't have much time later on. But he did say so. The last thing he ever wanted was getting into a war, either with Cuba or with the Soviet Union, and there wasn't. But there certainly was an awful lot of fuss made about it. And later on, at the anniversary, many years later, when some of the ones who were still around got together and commemorated what happened and shared things they couldn't talk about back then, they discovered things that literally said. They came very, very close to an accidental nuclear war, and you and I wouldn't be on the phone right now, John, talking about this if that had happened.
Well, I don't know about you, Stephen, but I'd be in heaven.
Well, I don't know where I would be, but I certainly wouldn't be on this program.
I'm just being silly.
But the risk of that something of that happen is much, much greater now, where you can be on a hair trigger and you can say, you can make false claims that a country like North Korea is building a bomb or they have a bomb and they may launch one. The last thing in the world North Korea would ever do is attack anybody with a nuclear bomb or probably any other bomb. And if they ever struck another country, South Korea or anybody with a nuclear bomb, it would be Armageddon for North Korea in 24 hours or less, and they know it, and they will go way out of their way to avoid anything approaching that kind of a conflict.
It's the same. That's also true of Iran. I mean,
oh, for sure. Iran doesn't have a bomb.
No, but even if they did, they wouldn't use it.
Oh, they wouldn't use it. And Iran has no nuclear weapons program, and I'm not saying, it's been a while since I mentioned it on this program, but it deserves repeating, because there'll be new nuclear talks beginning in Almaty, Kazakhstan, of all places, on the 27th of February, 10 days from today. It'll be the next round of what they call P5 plus 1. The major countries, the UN, Russia, China, Britain, Germany, Iran, of course, participating, it's about them. But the talks are rigged. There were multiple previous talks. They all were rigged by Washington and Israel behind the scenes to fail. This one will be exactly the same.
Sure.
I don't say that Iran doesn't have a nuclear program. The U.S. intelligence assessment, the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies every year come out with a global terrorist assessment annually, and every year they say the same thing in Iran. There is no evidence whatever that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. It adds, we don't know that they don't have one, but we can't find any evidence to show that they do have one. Well, there's no country in the world that's more heavily surveilled in all respects than Iran. And if U.S. intelligence, after all these years, can't find a smidgen of evidence that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, they don't. America knows it. Israel knows it. The other P5 countries know it. The U.N. knows it. Yet they keep accusing Iran of having a clandestine program that does not exist. And it won't end. Because I have another line, John. I say the beating up of an Iran has nothing to do with its peaceful nuclear program. It's red herring cover for regime change. The issue with Iran isn't its government, whether it's democratic or despotic or anything in between, whether it's secular or religious. It's an independent government, and America tolerates no independent governments. It wants pro-Western vassal states, puppet governments. That's what went on in Libya, in Iraq, in Afghanistan now, in Syria now, and what's going on with Iran that, heaven help us, possibly could morph into war. It's very possible.
Yeah, that's true. That all the United States wants to do in Iran is put the thought of Iran's son back in power. That's all. I mean, didn't Libya work out wonderfully for
him? Oh, boy, did it ever.
Did it ever. But I want to make another point. You know, I was listening to the hearings when Brennan was being questioned about being head of the CIA, and they brought up this question of, didn't you say that waterboarding elicited some really good intelligence that saved American lives? And he said, yeah, he had said that, but now that he had read the report put out by the House's committee on this, that he'd have to reconsider all of that. And I thought to myself, now why doesn't somebody stand up and say, look, if you had been told by the CIA that intelligence you got from that waterboarding was useful, and now you're reading a report that says that it's not useful and that you're not sure it's useful and you don't really know what happened, doesn't that mean that somebody in your organization, the organization you want to be head of, lied? But of course nobody asked that question.
Nobody asked the obvious questions. And,
no, they never do.
Well, the senator didn't lay a glove on Brennan. He's a killer, a murderer. He should be prosecuted. He should be in prison. So should Obama. So should George Bush and a whole lot of them. None of that ever happens, John. And he'll be
and I'll tell you why that is. That's because the city of Nuremberg isn't in the United States.
Boy, do we need another Nuremberg tribunal. We need a repeat on that. And, over time, I've written plenty on the tribunal and the fact that that a U.S. Supreme Court justice, Justice Robert Jackson, talked about the, I like to use the phrase imperial war. Once in a while, I say war of aggression. He talked about war of aggression when one country attacks another, premeditated attack. A non-belligerent country, which, of course, is what the Germans did and the Japanese did, and he called that the supreme international crime against peace. It's a greater crime than any other crime. Nothing rises to the level of aggressive war, and America has waged aggressive war one after another. You start losing count. There have been so many, and what's going on now? They're all lawless wars of aggression, and if we had a Nuremberg tribunal, an honest one run by people other than Americans, then the leading Americans who are still living would be in the dock, they'd be prosecuted, and they'd probably get the same justice the convicted Nazis got. They were hanged.
Yeah.
The hanging is too easy.
There's only one thing that is apt to keep that, you know, to keep the world from exploding into pieces, and that is that the bankers, having impoverished most of the people in the Western world, cannot continue to fight wars worldwide without paying for it by themselves. And that's something that I'm looking forward to seeing.
That would be marvelous if it ever could happen, John.
They won't happen. They'll change things. They'll find some other way to suck the money and wealth out of the rest of the world. They're not going to pay to fight a war to do it.
The only way to get rid of the bankers, John, is if the U.S. system implodes because of the excesses that simply reach a breaking point. They hit a wall and they simply come apart. The House of Cards. The House of Cards simply comes apart. And a regular on this program who I miss so dearly, Bob Chapman, who used to come on, he was a long time insider. He still had connections. He put out a twice weekly international forecast of publication. It had marvelous stuff in it, inside information that he discussed before anybody ever did, and sometimes the things that he talked about nobody ever discussed. And he talked about hitting the wall at some point. He couldn't predict when, but his last predictions, and he repeated them a few times, he died. He died the last spring. It was a terrible shock to me, and I remember the last time he was on this program. He used to come on during the week. The last time he came on, it wasn't the same guy, and I didn't know what was wrong, and he didn't talk about his illness, but he'd been ill for a number of months, and he couldn't come on the next month. He didn't feel well. I thought, well, maybe in a few weeks he'll be better. He'll come back. He never came back, and I think he died around last May. A great loss. He thought the House of Cards would collapse sometime between late last year and 2017, but he was very adamant in what he had to say. The excesses are so extreme, and there's no let-up in them. And, of course, the bankers bear the main responsibility and the major central banks, and sooner or later what can't go on forever won't. Maybe I'm young enough so that I'll see that day come, John, when the whole thing will come. That's the one way to get rid of these bankers. You're not going to break them up. You're not going to disempower them. But if they fall in their own swords because of their excess, that's the way they'll go.
Yeah,
I'm going to have a party if it happens.
You know, it's interesting, and I don't see why the bankers don't realize this themselves, that is, fiat money has no intrinsic value, and all of their money is fiat money. And, if it loses its value, they're gone.
And it's going to lose its value at some point.
At some point it's going to lose its value. I mean, you know, if every government if one major government like England or the United States, and maybe even France, you know, had the courage to stand up to them like the government of Iceland has, they could, you know, we could, if we had a Congress, simply say that Federal Reserve notes were no longer currency, that, you know, and that would be the end of it. To issue some greenbacks like Lincoln did, and we could do it. But that's not going to happen. Which reminds me, do you ever talk to what's her name, Ellen Brown?
Oh yeah, Ellen comes on.
Well,
Ellen, she's got surgery coming up. She had a hip surgery. She's got another one coming up. Some days from now. She'll be back on this program in early March. I wanted to get her back in late February, but I think it coincided with her hip surgery. And, you got to do what you got to do, but she'll be back in early March. She does marvelous writing.
I was wondering why she hasn't said anything about why none of the bills that had been introduced 4 years ago after her pieces became well-known in state legislatures, that none of them have gone anywhere.
Well, it really is a shame.
There must be some reason for that, and I'd like to have somebody expose it.
John, I just got word from my studio that we're supposed to be off the air now.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to wrap up and thank you, and I'll email you. I look forward to getting you back next month, and I'll remind my listeners to tune in every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, and weekends, Saturday and Sunday, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit for information you can't afford not to be without. Many thanks, John.
You know, Steve, tell that fat lady she's got to sing.
I can barely hear her. Thanks, John.